Welcome to today's big panel, and it's quite gender imbalanced, I have to say. Because I tell you what, because all the wonderful women we invited today to come on stage, they all canceled just like an hour ago. So Simone Davalos can't be here and the other. Okay, so please, we try to gender bend
all
ourselves, I guess, on stage. Yeah. Okay. Okay. So, welcome to our panel, the Ars Electronica second day panel, The Erotic of the Machine. And I would like to introduce our panelists. Here we have Daniel Fabri. He's part of Monochrome. He is co-editor of the Pronovation book, which is available for $20. Thanks a lot. Over there. Where's Whale, actually? Whale is somewhere here. Ah, there he is. Ta-ta! To research, I guess. Daniel is teaching information design at the University of Applied Sciences in Graz, and he's dealing a lot with user interfaces, and I guess you'll have a couple of things to tell us. We have Stéphane Perrin, who is from France, but actually at the moment lives and works in Japan. And he's one of the winners of the Prix Ars Electronica this year with his wonderful series of controversial dildos. And I think concerning death and sex and erotic of the machine, it's wonderful to have him on stage tonight. Another winner, we have Benjamin Cowden, whose machine actually is here. It's over there. What's actually the title of it? I can't remember it all the time.
Eating My Cake and Having It Too. The title is Eating My Cake and Having It Too.
Eating My Cake and Having It Too. There's no cake. It's just like, as I said, it's outsourcing the fetish to the machine, so we don't even have it to do it ourselves. We have Alan Stein of Thrillhammer, who we actually, I don't know why I haven't asked yet, but here he is, and he is one of the big men, I have to say, concerning penetration devices. Can I?
Teledildonics.
Yes, teledildonics. Okay.
With penetration.
That sounds
devices.
Nicer, yes. Then. Yeah, okay. We have Violet Blue. She's nearly everywhere. I don't know where she is not. She's a sex blogger. She is a sex... Can I say educator? Is
what?
A sex educator? Can I? Yes. Agitator, of course. Of course. She's just fabulous, and it's wonderful to have her here today. And there's even controversy included and all this stuff. Wonderful. So we'll have it's good to have you here. And good that he could actually make it, because he has to go to the next panel or whatever in an hour. Thomas Roach, who is... what are you not doing? You are writing erotic fiction. You are a sex educator. You are very much interested in BDSM. You're just a character, I guess.
I'm also the public relations manager at kink.com, which hosted the Ars Electronica conference last year, so, and not this year. So.
Yeah. Okay. So actually, I haven't thought about any specific questions, because we all know what we're doing and what we're talking about all the time, and this topic of the erotic of the machine is pretty wide open. So actually, I would like to ask the first non-question to Thomas Roach. What do you think about when I would ask you, what is erotic about a machine?
Well, I think that for me, there's a couple of different aspects to that. I think that nowadays when we think of machines, I mean, this was really always true, but it's particularly true nowadays. When we think machines, the word machine for me conjures up something that's more like a factory or more like kind of a pumping piston sort of almost, you know, steam engine sort of thing. And I think that a machine is anything, you know, any mechanical device that does what we tell it to or almost what we tell it to, or argues with us. So a computer being a machine, for me, I think that my sexuality has been completely enabled by computers. I think that's true of most people, many people with any kind of divergent sexuality or anything that's esoteric about what they're interested in. Really, I think the field of sexuality has completely changed by what are probably the most important machines available now, which are information machines, and that we have to remember that when we're thinking of machines and what's erotic about them, there's two things: there's the physical and the innovation. Now that said, I also think that it's important to look at the ways in which machinery kind of defines human development, and so all of the movement of people into cities in the 20th century has largely been enabled by the fact that we have easy, cheap machinery that makes those things possible, that makes transportation possible, that makes all sorts of relocation and shipping of goods possible. And I think that machines are so such an integral part of our life that it really defines what our social world is like. And machines themselves are just really, really hot. Definitely I think there's a huge sexuality. And actually Lester Bangs, who is a great rock and roll writer, wrote a very, very nice essay about, this was specifically about the Velvet Underground, but he was talking about the fact that the human body and the lines of a really well-made car are essentially evoke the same sort of aesthetic response in humans. I think that's very true. I think that any item of beauty, and this is certainly true of art and machinery, what is machinery if not a type of art? If it's art that works, it's art that does something. It may be practical, but it's an art form getting it to that point where it's doing what it's practically supposed to. So I think all aspects of human experience are reflected in machines, and that's sort of important to remember. So that's where I come from. That's my perspective.
So it's a pretty industrial perspective, I guess. When I think of machines, I think of, 19th century things going on. So
even the word has this connotation of sort of industrial, like pumping sort of machinery, and all of those things are very important, but a machine is anything inanimate or presumably inanimate that interacts with us, that we are able to task to do something. And the things that we task machines to do are increasingly intimate. And it seems, even 10 years ago, the variety of sex toys that were available was, minimal at best. And now it's amazing, the variety we have, let alone the fact that now you actually have machines that will provide thrusting motion, so you can actually get off if vibration is not all you're looking for. The things that we're expecting machines to do are increasingly parts of our lives in ways that, they really weren't even just 10 years ago, even 5 years ago. So
I think it would be a good idea to pass the microphone to Violet, because if you're talking about, there's this Cambrian explosion of sex toys in the last 10 years, so what do you think about that? So what does it tell us about society?
What does it tell us about society? Well, I think that I think that it tells us that society is becoming a lot more tolerant of the sexualization of machines and robots in general. But I remember 7 or 8 years ago when I was working the floor at Good Vibrations, when I would be selling vibrators, and male customers would come in to buy a vibrator for their girlfriend for the first time or their wife for the first time, and they would often joke, and it was often something that we would sort of have to sort of smooth over with them, the notion that they would not be replaced by this machine, because it was a constant insecurity that was being brought up, that this machine was something that could replace them in the bedroom in some way. And I think that speaks a lot to what is erotic about the machine, too, and why the interest is growing and growing, because there's a certain there's not just a mystery as to why someone would want to fuck a machine, but also there's a certain power exchange that goes on between the human and the machine, and the hardness of the machine and the softness and the vulnerability of the body. And I think it's just utterly fascinating. And I think that it's something that's been going on for a very long time. I'm going to totally massacre his name, but Villiers, I think his name was. He wrote The Future Eve in 1886. It was the first human-android sexualized relationship written in novel form about a man who cheated on his would-be spouse with an android. And so we have this sort of long-term fascination with making love to the machine and having sex with the machine, and in that aspect, it's a man having sex with a female gynoid, which translates just as easy today. Who is it? The man who wrote, David Levy, wrote Love and Sex with Robots. He's predicted that marriages between humans and robots will be legal within 5 to 20 years. But at the same time, we have people using online services to marry robots online, artificial identities online, and making sex dolls. So we have like the future Eve suddenly here.
We should probably declare gay people robots. That would pretty much solve the problem, because I'm not sure if in the next 15 or 20 years on like everywhere in the world there will be equal rights for gay people. I mean,
well, Levy did write a piece about the rights of robots and the rights of artificial intelligence entities, which is really interesting when you think about what artificial intelligence developers are doing. A lot of the activity is happening with the virtual girl, the virtual date, the carry girls. There's a really thriving online community of these men who have these artificial identity girlfriends. They're based on the Alice model, which is Dr. Richard Wallace's chatbot model, and they're developing them, and they're having these ongoing relationships with these women that they're creating, and they're marrying them in these online chapels and having these long-term relationships with them and sexual relationships with them, and we're just this close to having them put into a real doll body, I think. So, you know, it's fascinating. It sort of undermines a lot of our assumptions about sex with robots, I think.
Okay, Alan, it's maybe almost a philosophical question, but what's really the difference? I mean, you're a person who's like working on sex machines for a long time. So what's really the difference between a machine and a body? I mean, a body is like a chemical machine.
Well, the biggest difference, there's no real energy exchange with having sex with a machine. So the machines are never going to replace human interaction. I think it might be a nice accoutrement to the whole thing. But there's no energy exchange on the energetic level, I suppose. You know, a tantra-based machine might be kind of cool, but...
Could you tell us a little bit about...
Really?
I do. Well, when you think about the Japanese Tamagotchi craze, there was this one woman who had an utter meltdown. This is a little mobile creature that you carry around like a keychain sort of device, and you feed it with love. And there was a story of the one woman who had an utter meltdown when she was told that she couldn't take it on an airplane and refused to fly because she didn't want it to die. And also there were some questioning of I believe Hebrew law in Israel about shutting off devices, and there was a lot of discussion about the fact that, you know, the kids were going, we can't shut these off because they'll die. And so there are some questions to be raised about emotional bonding with machines, definitely.
Emotionally true. Energetically, I just don't see it yet on that side.
Okay. Tell us about what you're working at the moment. So what are your newest projects?
I have a couple of projects I've been working on lately. I'm setting up a studio in L.A. currently that has about 15 internet-controlled sex machines, from Symbians to... there's a guy in New Orleans that makes well-built machines, Ken's Twisted Mind, and some thrill hammers in a studio where people can log in and pay a per-minute fee to interact with a male or female model. So I've been coming back out and doing some more teledildonic stuff, and I still shoot sex machine porn to fuel my research into actually doing some biosensor work and developing wellness products.
That would be an interesting question. So we have Thomas Roach, who is working for kink.com, and is there some kind of like a battle between people who are doing fucking machines porn? Is there because the scene, I guess, is not too big, but still, I mean, there's a competition in the scene, I guess, or?
Well, I don't see it as a competition at all. It's been very strange, because when
Kink started launching fucking machines. I started doing the internet-controlled sex machines. So their business model was women on, you know, on video, whereas mine was a more live one-on-one video conferencing play. Now, take it, this is 8 years ago, so we're looking at Java Push and, you know, some Windows Media where you have, you know, you interact with the machine, you have to wait 5 seconds to see it catch up to you. So, you know, it, you know, I think it'd be great to, you know, work with Kink and, you know, especially with their arsenal of machines. I just have a heyday hooking up my controls to it and being able to bring a live aspect to it, because what I'm seeing on a commercial standpoint with Teledildonics that viewers come into the shows with these chat models. They're going to do web chat anyway, but when they come in there and they're able to be able to control the machine and actually have consummated sex, basically, they start forging a relationship with that customer. And instead of being a customer, that customer turns into a regular, comes back more often because they're interacting on a level that wasn't there before. So it's...
Yeah, I'd love to say something about that. I think that, I mean, I don't see any of it as competition as such. I mean, I'm, in a sense, I'm not on the business side of the business. I do public relations, so I want to be everybody's friend. But I think that all businesses that explore this stuff are really doing, it's a net positive. And the interesting thing from that perspective is that anybody who's doing sex machine development is developing stuff that may do the same basic set of things, but they all do it differently. And the variation is so extreme, especially in a field that's so overloaded with just sort of robotic, for lack of a better word, human-on-human interactions that are sort of predictable and the same sort of thing, and all the models, you know, look more or less the same. And even if there is more variation in body types and styles of models, you know, they're all human. And the machines actually offer a whole new set of things that I think is just barely being explored. I mean, really, the variety is enormous, because these things haven't really been specifically eroticized before, what, about 10 years ago, I guess, probably, roughly. And I know that when I was growing up, that was a complaint that I often had, was like, okay, vibrators, whoopee shit, you know. And now vibrators rotate, you know, dildos rotate, but, you know. And so so when I started seeing thrusting sex machines, it offered more variety. And also the interaction, at Kink, we really don't do on fucking machines much online controlling stuff or remote interactions. So I think that's a huge growth area that is going to really, I think it's going to be really important as people have more access to this technology.
As far as access to technology, there's really three people. Really, controlling sex devices on the internet, it's simple. You're just controlling voltage. So it's really not that hard to do. But getting the different service providers to work together and be able to have someone who has, say, a HiJoy device and someone who has a Thrill Hammer or a Symbian that's internet controlled, be able to say, okay, I have this control and I have this control. Let's pop the control. So what I'm working on now is more of a Teledildonic core set of APIs that people could just grab the APIs so they could go fuck each other.
Okay. Benjamin, you're coming from a completely different field. You're coming from art,
yeah.
Actually. And your machine wasn't constructed to be a sex machine, so we discovered it and said, hey, that's just wonderful. We want to open up the variety at the Art Pre-Ars Electronica. We definitely want you to invite. Wanted to invite you. So, did you think when you constructed the machine, or I mean, you are doing many, many different machines. We shouldn't just like focus on this machine here. What's your opinion on like the erotic of the machine?
Well, I guess I tend to be a lot more classic and a lot more art focused in my viewpoint, and I'm thinking more along the lines of, well, actually, Violet mentioned it, that the late 19th century, early 20th century, the tail end of the Industrial Revolution was when we started, as a society in the West, falling back in love with the machine, which we obviously, because of the beginning of the Industrial Revolution was so dark, everybody was afraid of machines. So the machine started to become erotic around that time, and that's when artists started utilizing the image of the machine as erotic. In a way, I kind of feel like it's a god fantasy on our part to envision the machine as erotic, because we create the machine in the same way that we in the West can't help but imagine that God created us. So the machine acts independently the way that we act independently, even though we were, I mean, it's I mean, I'm kind of relying on Western mythology, but.
Okay, yeah. But you could also say that, especially if you're talking about Taylorism and Fordism and all that stuff, that people also started to create robots out of people. Because like something like an assembly line is pretty much like there's a big mechanic thing going on, and people force people to pretty much be slaves of the machines. So it's just like it's not only like all the people like in assembly lines, they were not probably in love with their assembly lines, I guess.
No. Yeah. Yeah. That's what I was saying, that throughout the 19th century, people were, in general, afraid of machines and thought the machines were bad. I'm talking about, you know, lay people. Even though the thrust of industry was because of the economy was moving forward, no matter what people thought, and there was, you know, a generally negative view of machines. But then once the Industrial Revolution kind of hit its stride and everybody started kind of benefiting, at least economically, from the progress that machines were making. I don't know, I feel like I'm stepping in weird territory here, but people started having a more positive view of machines, and that's when people started being able to look at machines as erotic.
Okay. Maybe we go on to Stefan, because Stefan, I mean, you were mentioning like the West mythology, and Stefan is from France, but now he's living in Japan for a couple of years. Yeah. And maybe it would be interesting to see a Japanese perspective, or what you think could be a Japanese perspective. What do you think, especially if you're thinking about Japanese pop culture, you think about anime and stuff like that going on. What do you think?
I think one of the big difference when I saw when I learned about this conference and I started to think about what I could do, first difference was I was looking at what has already been done in this for this kind of things, and so all these machines, and in Japan it's kind of not very practicable to do this kind of thing. It's too big. You have no room to do this kind of thing. So I think the usually when you think about something there, it's very rarely mechanical things, very big things. So I was more like just working on my computer. That's why.
I mean, because I'm thinking that. I mean, maybe I jump back to Alan. For example, customers in Japan? Do you have any? Because I'd like to get into this like culture difference thing a little bit, because we're talking here from a quite Western perspective, and I'd like to open this thing up about what's the rotting in the machine in the West, and what is it possibly in the East? I don't know.
Yeah, my customers. I had more data on that when I was running membership sites, so I could see, you know, where the traffic was coming from, and I did have traffic from Japan, but it wasn't significant on that. Then what I do is I produce sex machine content for a variety of other companies, so each company has their own niche, and each little niche has their own version of what's erotic to that niche. Say, for example, I shoot for one company, Homegrown Video. They want amateur women. So it's amateur girls on machines having real orgasms, and the draw to that series itself and that niche is real orgasms. Whereas from another one, Wild Fuck Doors, I play a doctor and I cure people of their orgasmic ailments with all these variety of machines. That's more appealing to a different type of, more I would say the Maxim type of crowd, like people who say dude a lot. So. Culturally, you know, it varies depending on the niche the machines are in, I would imagine.
Violet.
I wanted to add something to that, too. It's interesting that you bring up the efficiency aspect of the Japanese take on sex and machines, because one thing I've learned working in the sex industry and the sex toy industry is that some of the best vibrators in the world come from Japan, and they've really, really refined the art of the vibrator there, and they have for a very long time. And I mean, that's Japanese vibrators are very expensive. They're made of high-quality materials. They have excellent motors. They come in a mind-boggling array of shapes and sizes. Some are very scary-looking. And they've done a lot of really interesting development around doing different types of add-ons for sex machines. Like I just recently blogged about a Japanese, it looks like a Japanese little girl's school lunchbox. It's really creepy looking. It looks Hello Kitty. But it's an attachment for a fleshlight, which is a male masturbation sleeve device. And basically what it does is it turns it into a thrusting device. So it's, it looks like a little lunchbox gun, essentially. It's very interesting. But I just, you know, considering the, you know, in, at least in the history of my working in the industry, the best sex toys have always come from Japan. The weirdest sex toys have always come from Japan. But they just seem to keep developing and keep developing and pushing out more, and it's really fascinating. And there's a lot of other like mystique around sex toys from Japan and stories about why they're not, you know, physiologically shaped and things like that. But did you have something to add?
Yeah, I just wanted to add very quickly that for what it's worth, if it's worth anything, one of the very few times that Kink.com has gotten into DVD production has been in conjunction with a Japanese company that released a Fucking Machines DVD. So I just find that interesting that there was that interest, and they approached Kink. So that's just interesting. I think this does have appeal in Japan in that way. So
I love the video of you guys packing up your machines to go to Japan, though. It was priceless.
I just wanted to add something about they have vibrator and a lot of things, but especially they have a very advanced technology for dolls, for Dutch wives, and they have all reviews and books about that, and it's sometimes pretty creepy because it's very well made and it's extremely expensive, made very, a lot of companies are specialized in that, and they do kind of case-by-case model, so you can ask for a model. And, well, people are asking for sometimes strange things, so, and then there is all this review where people are acting with these dolls and they take pictures, or explaining all the, because usually you can just change a lot of elements on the dolls. And you have several pages in the review just about vagina, which one is the best with all the statistics and these kind of things. And it's quite interesting, but sometimes a bit strange, yeah.
Okay. So, Daniel, your speciality, and you've been working about that for a long, long, long time, is theremins, you know, like touchless devices. So, like you did a couple of even for Ars Electronica, you did a drinking device that you don't even have to touch and stuff like that. I would be interested in what's your take on the erotic of the machine?
Not for
Robic Sotica, of course. Sorry. So, what's your take on the erotic of the machine concerning like input or touch or non-touch? I don't know. Yeah.
I think the theremin is maybe a good example for an interface that maybe is some kind of more erotic than, I don't know, a button or the keyboard or the mouse, etc. Because it maybe lets a little bit more space for maybe fantasy, which in my opinion is, I mean, maybe it's a romantic fear of eroticism, but it makes more open space to your fantasy, your connections, your experiences. You could connect, but just approaching to an object, or just approaching to, or just entering a room. So if you don't touch it, but you have to get closer to it, that makes, I think that's just more interesting than touching a haptic device.
So would it be interesting to think about not only like fucking machines, but whole fucking spaces in a certain way, that you're moving around in a space and you have like a whole environment, like a sensual sexual environment that's not only like, you know.
Oh yes, absolutely. That's a good idea, and I think I mean the whole cyberspace and cybersex thing, which was a big topic technologically in the 80s and 90s, but then there was a drop off, and now it comes slowly again. All the multi-display environments or immersive environments in exhibitions, for example, where you can sense by various sensorics and have feedback by audio, video, etc., which is very immersive if you have surround projection, for example. So it's also possible to, could be an interesting topic to make erotic rooms and use the pheromone as a sensor, for example.
Okay, wouldn't it be interesting because everybody was thinking of, hey, the virtual reality is coming along and now we'll have like virtual sex realities and stuff, but it never really, really happened. Wouldn't it be better to think about like augmented sex reality? So, I mean, having like, you know,
eyeglasses
that whatever, I don't know.
For the street and maybe a program ads.
It's like this like really cheap ads in this pulp magazines where you have like this x-ray, like cheap x-ray glasses where you can see women naked and stuff like that from the 1950s. You remember that?
Yeah.
Oh my gosh. I wonder if anyone really bought it. I don't know. Okay. But I would like to drop that into the round, this like maybe like an augmented sexual device. I don't know.
It's sort of interesting. While you're talking about the just, you know, the way a theremin or the way that, you know, the touch and the movement of working a theremin could work itself into a sexual environment, sort of was making me think of what you were saying earlier, Thomas, about the intimacy of our gadgets. And so I was sort of brainstorming a little bit about the sort of like the, what would the consumer side of something like that look like? And there's something called a V-Girl that you can download, and she is a virtual girlfriend. And she's an artificial intelligence entity, and there are five or six different types. They're different skin tones, body types, et cetera, et cetera. And of course, there's a fee. There's an ongoing fee to have this relationship with the V girl, and you know, get her to undress and do sexy dances for you and things like that. And she's constantly sort of like baiting you on to, you know, of course, continue the payments. But what I'm wondering is how this is going to tie into, you know, the rush to sort of, because I pay attention a lot to cell phones and the cell phone market, because it's one of those devices that is just always, it is one of the most intimate devices we have. We have it with us at all times with the touch screen. Like, what are the, I wonder what the possibilities are going to be with computer controlled, you know, doing teledildonics with your iPhone, you know, like fucking a girl with your iPhone while you're on your commute or something, or, you know.
I'm not a good programmer, but I always was thinking of a device that pretty much works like that. So maybe we can have like a virtual pussy or something like that. I don't know. But yeah, it's fine. It was made in China. So, okay. Yeah, Thomas.
I just want to say, I think that's a really good point that we are, you know, we forget that there's two things, there's input and there's output. The talk that Kyle Mikulis gave last year was about, essentially, the bulk of it was about output devices, about things that can stimulate you, but the input is equally important to a real, like, in-person sexual enterprise. And, I mean, you were just licking a touch screen, which is a very funny image, but at the same time, though, I think it is important to think that we have these touch screens and we're increasingly interactive, you know, with things like touch screens that react based on what the software state is, you know, what the state of the device is, and something like, and how we're physically touching it. So it's very, very sensitive and will be increasingly sensitive to the kind of finer points of a human touch that are not, you know, I mean, ultimately they can be rendered digitally, but they really they're really complicated and they're extremely subtle. So I think that is something that hasn't really been explored in terms of in terms of the physics of interacting with a computer in particular, and therefore with a more physically acting machine. And I wonder if that the place that we're going to see this really sort of intimate development isn't going to be in the fine arts, where computer artists are creating all sorts of things. And I'm not at all an artist, but I know that the artists that I see sort of work with a few devices that look a little more complicated than my mouse. Or my touchpad, and I think that is very interesting for visual art. Think of visual artists and the subtleties that they need to be able to create a piece of visual art on the computer being similar to the kind of work that you need to do in the physical space to have a good sexual experience.
Yeah, Daniel, is there anything going on in the realms of art and exhibition design, stuff like that, that may be interesting for our discussion?
All the mediums in the action designers, they're exploring different interfaces now, and different interface technologies are coming more a cultural technique, you could say it like this, because if you have the iPod, for example, it was a slow development from buttons to the wheel, etc., and then next step, just the wheel and no buttons, etc. And it took some time to make it as a cultural technique, also touch screens, for example. So there are really, really a lot of interfaces and technologies now on a very high state and is accessible and is also affordable, for example. But I think it's the tricky thing about that is to make the right content and to make the right interaction design, how you used it. For example, I mean the Wii controller, for example, the technology, we had it in the 70s or 60s, and there were several tries by, for example, Nintendo with different interfaces, and lots of them crashed on the market. But now the Wii somehow made it, and I think it doesn't take too much time to learn a very broad audience or users, maybe how to deal with a Wii, for example. So it's just always the same: exploring new interfaces, exploring new technologies, and but the way should be what's the content and what's the right interface for it, and then the new design for that.
Stefan, what's your take on interfaces? I mean, you're dealing with interfaces a lot, I guess.
I like to work with sensor, different kind of things. So, except for the third of the series, we have this one as a sensor. The other one are just actuators because they don't sense anything. But I've not seen a lot of work done about how to sense the kind of erotic or sexual state of a person. Because you have a sensor, like you can have temperature or humidity for if people are sweating or these kind of things, they are excited. But of course, in kind of serious literature, they never talk about sexual application of these kind of things. So I think it's kind of interesting way to have this or this sensor for body, or I mean body state of the body, and that can be used with a very small device now. So
okay, yeah. In art, there's a lot of like, especially in the 1960s and 1970s, there was a lot of body art and actionism stuff going on, and especially like in, for example, films like David Cronenberg, because David Cronenberg is not he's pretty much like an artist who somehow like tried to express his thoughts not like in installations or environments, but in film. And David Cronenberg is a pretty excellent example, I guess, to think about sexuality and interfaces. I mean, if you have something like the scene in Videodrome where the guy pretty much crawls into the TV screen is such a brilliant and like erotic or somehow like uncanny thing to do. Benjamin, what do you think? What are your in art now, like in the last like 10, 15 years, what do you think concerning the erotic of the machine? What are a couple of really good things that happened? Or not happened in a way that what got stuck in your mind?
Boy, I don't see a whole lot going on that in the art world currently that I find extremely interesting in terms of eroticism and the machine. Just I feel like machines in general are actually pretty unpopular with artists right now.
Also, I mean, there are things like ArtBots, for example, in New York, where people create machines that create art or art themselves. Stuff like that is going on. But but you're right. It seems to be a kind of niche market in art. Or
so I've been thinking about what we've been talking about, and we've mentioned touch screens, and we've mentioned the theremin, and it's interesting. I find the theremin to be immediately erotic. But touch screens, I don't find them to be erotic. They may be a medium for erotic content, but in terms of the inherent eroticism of a machine, I'm kind of racking my brain trying to think of other things that are popular right now.
I mean, it just came to my mind that I did an installation using the theremin and for controlling some kind of erotic content. It was, but I don't know the film, I don't know the movie, but maybe that's not too important. It was a movie, quite popular punk movie, maybe Annika knows the title of the film, but it had a lot of brutal content and sex content, and it was about the relationship of a girl and a man through brutality, sexuality, etc. And I took just a couple of scenes where the characters touching each other, or also having sex with each other, and so the scenes just switched from one scene to the other, and you could near to an interface which was a mask from this film, a strong symbol on it, and you could get nearer to it and then controlling the movie clips and for example this couple having sex with each other, or another scene where they hit each other because they were at a fight, etc. in this movie. And it was displayed at Ars Electronica, the Ars Electronica in Austria.
Yeah, the Linz one. Okay.
The Linz one. And people were really afraid of using it because it somehow involved them in something they just saw the movie clips, but they realized that when they come closer, they are somehow involved in the scene which was going on, having sex, for example, between those two characters, or hitting each other. So some of them really enjoyed it, but others did. Oh, what am I doing here? I'm having sex, or I'm controlling people having sex with each other, etc.
So that's something not for the problem would probably be that they didn't want being seen like controlling a sex scene. Maybe there's a business model for home technology. I don't know. Okay, Thomas. We've been talking about interfaces. I mean, you're part of kink.com. Is there anything interesting going on concerning research about interfaces at kink.com?
We haven't done a whole lot of interface work. Now, I'm not really privy to the actual technical details of the machines. I just don't happen to work on them. But generally, the model usually is that the model, the woman who's getting fucked, is controlling the device. So you know, the important the important developments were sort of made early, I think. And I'm not really familiar with anything new that's coming out. Most of what we're developing is more around the social networking area, which I think will become important in terms of like online one-to-one interactions with machines. But I don't think that interface work has really been done yet, not by us at least.
Okay, yeah, Violet, please. No.
Okay.
Okay. Ellen. Okay.
Well, in the design of our interfaces, when we started, you know, getting the machines controlled on the internet, the first thing we were looking at is what were other people doing. And one of the things out there was this nightmare, the simulator. It had this dashboard, and it looked like a video game. And that is so far from being erotic to anybody.
Kyle Matulis was presenting it last year as like the worst possible sexual interface.
Awful.
Out there.
And you got to walk a fine line because you really want to design an interface that's intimate but still have the usability factor there, because you got to figure these people who are going to be controlling these machines, you know, it's got to be as simple as possible and try and make it intimate at the same time. So my controls are very, very simple. It's just...
But then we're talking about Cronenberg again, because the interface in existence is so wonderful. This like... It's because it's soft. Like I think it was like almost crawling into the or touching this like play device. I don't know. Is there anything going on concerning like non-hard? I can describe it other way, like non-hard interfaces or squishy or soft interfaces. I don't know.
I wanted to just say one thing about that. I think existence is a very good example. It's really interesting to think about that, because that whole, and this is kind of Cronenberg's thing, is this organic machine, you know, not so much that humans interface with machines, but we sort of, machines are built out of human tissue or some sort of bio tissue, which I think is interesting. But as far as sex machines go, the first time I ever used a sex machine was very simple, just a dial that made it go fast, and it was very, very sensitive, and I was blown away. This was probably about 2000, maybe 2001, and I was completely blown away because it was so simple. And I don't really, that's exactly, yes, exactly cool. This kind of device. And I was completely liberated by the fact that it was simple, because for me, the having actual in-person sex, the complications of all the physical stuff is actually more confusing to me than dealing with digital data, since I'm used to dealing with words primarily. And so I actually find it very appealing, the idea that this is a very simple set of axes, and it actually helps me envision non-machine, real-world, entirely biological sex. To think of it in terms of sort of a grid or a set of stimuli, rather than this very complicated thing that you might see in Cronenberg, which is what real interfaces are like, real biological interfaces are like.
I think the closest we're going to start to see the widespread use of something like that is through companies like RealDoll, who are actually making large, soft sex toys that are very popular and very available to consumers who have money. They're around $6,000. And they've been working on putting actuators in their hips and motorizing them for quite a while now. So
there was a dental robot that was designed actually to train dentists in Japan, in which the robot would respond if when you were working on her teeth, and it was a female robot. It looked very realistic. It was very strange.
If you touched her breasts, she would tell you to stop.
Right, which is very interesting. So, I mean, these things, and she would react if you hit the wrong nerve. Like, if you drilled and did it wrong, she would react in pain, which
it's,
obviously
it's
is
puppet
like,
empowerment.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. No.
I have an off-topic sort of burning question to ask Thomas,
okay.
Actually, if you don't mind.
Go on, please.
So, we're talking about fucking machines, and fucking machines has been a really popular site for a very long time, and it's probably made piles of money. And basically what it is it's porn. It's girls fucking machines. It's girls being fucked by machines. Why do people want to see that?
Why is it so popular? I've heard there are two competing theories. The theory that I hear most often is because it's heterosexual men who don't want to see other guys on camera, but find it hot to have girls get fucked. I actually don't buy into that. I believe there's more to it than that. I think that the fascination that women have with the machines, a lot of them, I think, is because you know, they fantasize themselves being serviced in that way, and I think that's really hot to a lot of women. But even just the visual pleasure that women take from it, you know, I think is really intense, and I think there's way more to it. I don't think it is just people who don't want to see guys. I think that it's like this, I think it's all sorts, all sorts of the variety that's available from you know, from a girl being fucked by a machine. And let's face it, we can build a machine to fuck a girl a lot harder and a lot longer and a lot more steadily than a human is ever going to be able to do it. So I think that's a lot of the appeal.
There's an
and in fact, kink.com, actually, you set the world record for female ejaculation with some of your fucking machines in a measured competition, and I think it was 15 feet. Was that?
15 feet. Was that Annie Crusoe? I think it was Annie Crusoe. And that, and she's like, she's kind of a special case because when you've got her, she's like a just like copious ejaculator. So it's kind of, you know, a special case. That's almost cheating because it's almost like having Superman, you know, do weightlifting.
I mean, and there's like in the Pronovation book, there is a one-page short article by Binks, who had sex with Faxilla last year at Ars Electronica, and she's it's a really, really good text, and she is pretty much explaining first wave, second wave, and third wave feminism, and she's referring to third wave feminism when she says, "Why did I have sex with a machine?" And third wave feminism, pretty much, she explains it in a way that you say, "Hey, I don't even need a man now, so if not, I can, but I don't need to." So it's okay. Ellen, donk.
With you, it's a different case because people are controlling the machine; they're not watching.
True.
Well, the machine, per se,
yeah. Well, the porn I do shoot is for a couple distinct markets. So the stuff I shoot in the amateur market is for people who want to see real orgasms. So it's about real women and real orgasms for that series, and people find that highly erotic. And that's why it got me into control, you know, internet controlling machines. Then there's the, you know, the Maxim crowd, or, you know, the dude crowd who likes to see, you know, women just get fucked by machines. And there's, you know, less erotic, but appealing nonetheless. But then you have the control aspect of the online teledildonics, where, you know, they actually get to consummate the relationship, and, you know, that translates, you know, from a commercial standpoint into longer shows, which is, you know, when we do a price elasticity study on it, yeah, we could charge $11 a minute for it, but if we charge, you know, a normal rate and just do it as added value, people stay in there twice as long. You know, I just found people who are interested in just playing with the camera, you know, and then, you know, not even driving the machine. You know.
Is there actually gay machine porn? I think it's, yeah, but it's not a lot, I guess.
Well, Kink did a site called Butt Machine Boys. I want to say it was like 2001 to 2005 or something. It was of limited success for a variety of reasons. The argument that I've heard as to why that didn't really work is because guys who want to watch guys get fucked want to watch guys get fucked by other guys, which I don't know if I necessarily buy that. I'm not really sure why that didn't work, but that was, and that's the only gay machine porn, like in sort of large scale that I've ever encountered, but it must exist somewhere. Do you know, Alan?
Not quite sure, but I placed my initial ads for hiring for my studio in LA, and it's been overwhelmingly 70% men, 30% women from the general populace.
And the men want to get
Come in and get fucked all day.
Yeah.
Okay, we're here in the Bay Area, and the Bay Area, we are here like in the center of machine culture, I would say. Maybe not machine culture, but anyway, there's Silicon Valley around the corner. That's why we're having Ars Electronica here, because it's such an interesting environment to have to talk about technology and sex. Still, I think, especially if you're talking about business stuff, and there's this whole, you know, like family thing going on. So is the web industry, is the, like, is Silicon Valley actually really ready for the erotic of the machine? What do you think? Why don't you care?
I think we're the epicenter of it. I mean, we've been the epicenter of so many aspects of sex culture in general and tech culture And I think there's a really good reason for that, and I think it has to do with the types of people that are interested in technology and the types of people that are interested in sex. And I think that there's a lot in common with both types of people. I mean, there's so much overlap. When you come to a conference like this, or you go to a hacker conference, or you go to a sex conference, you often run into a lot of the same people. So I think that it's not that we're ready for it. I think that we've been doing it all along.
And I'm just thinking, because when I'm talking to people also from the Bay Area about, hey, we are Monochrome, we're doing a conference about sex and technology, many, many people kind of laugh about it and say it's not that they are like offended by it, but it's somehow like, yeah, of course, but it's not that I don't have the feeling that they are completely like it's not everyday life in a certain way.
Well, it depends, I guess, on what circles you end up traveling in around the Bay Area.
Google and
right.
It's also just about money. I mean, Silicon Valley has, you know, people who has a large number of people with a fair amount of income, and they're the ones who can afford to experiment with you know, with all sorts of stuff. I mean, down to buying an iPhone, you know, even if you want to just get really basic about experimentation.
So it reminds me of Metropolis, where the idle rich would have their children play in the gardens above while the people toiled with the machines below.
Okay, Benjamin, you're from the Bay Area, and you're doing art, machine art. And there's this long backstory of, you know, people like Mark Pauling, like giant destructive machines. I mean, there's lots of, like, you can talk about big machines killing each other. I mean, there's lots of erotic things going on there, I guess. So I don't want to be Freudian here and stuff, but let's skip that.
Let's
so,
get Freudian.
Huh? Let's get Freudian. A Freudian slippery when wet. Yeah.
I think it's fair to say that we make machines, so we're going to make them sexy, right? Don't we do that?
You build. I never built a machine. So actually, when you built installations, were you thinking about this concept of like it has to be appealing? So, I mean, I guess it depends on the concept you're trying to present.
I think anybody who's involved in engineering, even you know, product design, engineers, and artists. Well, let me clarify. Artists that make kinetic and interactive work want the things that they build to make people want to touch them, and that's what I think about. And you know, I think that's a common thread. I even think, you know, Mark Pauling and Survival Research Labs. I mean, those machines aren't the kind of things that you're going to want to touch, but the implied power in those machines is kind of erotic in a way. It's you know, it's destructive, but that calls to mind the whole idea of creation and destruction. That, you know, there's something kind of sexual in that. Yeah.
I just want to also add that if you take a look at Benjamin's work online, it's 27gears.com. To me, it reminds me of an artist named Arthur Ganson. You use a lot of worm gears. And they're very sinuous. If you take a look at that machine over there and the way it works and you look at his work, a worm gear, just the way that it's shaped, it's very curvaceous. It's very tactile looking and tactile feeling. So it's almost impossible not to want to sexualize something like a worm gear, just simply by the way that it moves and undulates when you turn it with your hand. You know, and when you talk about machines at Survival Research Laboratories, which I worked on for 12 years, I mean, they're dripping with grease, and they're dirty, and they're powerful, and they're loud, and they're overpowering, and they're insanely sexy for all of those reasons, because, you know, it's just the way that watching the gears go together, and it's sloppy, you know, and it's scary. So there are just so many, machines are just sexy, and it's so funny listening to you say that, and just look like I'm thinking of your machines and the way the worm gears move and go together, and it's just like...
I guess, Stefan, you wanted to add something, yeah?
More like a question, but yeah, I can understand the, well, of course, between machine with a free, the moving part that can be like a body, and so there's some kind of erotism in it. But I wanted to ask people, I never built a machine myself, so I don't know, but I feel like when you spend time, energy, and eventually talent in building a machine, I think it's become kind of a part of yourself, and I think what if I was to build a machine, I think one of the appeal to do that and what will kind of excite me after would be to think that this part of me will be used by other people and somehow I will be part of this.
So is there let's rephrase
the question is more like does people who have built machine does this notion of have the machine be part of themselves drive them to build this machine?
I mean the question for you would actually then be is there
the main thought between building a machine, mostly as a hobbyist, I think, like someone who just built his own machine in a garage or something, and by putting a lot of time, energy in building this machine, it becomes like a part of you. And I can imagine that you can fantasize about then have a relation with or physical, sexual relation with people you don't maybe know, but you still have this relation somehow.
I would
like to ask if people who have built this machine have this driving force behind.
I have a relationship with my first machine.
But do you have a relationship with all the customers?
Oh,
then?
Yeah.
That's the question. Because Peter Acero presented last year his film Love Machine. He didn't really present it here. He showed it at Ars Electronica. I guess it's like 5 years old now. And there is an interview with a guy, I don't know its name, but he's almost obsessed with like creating sex machines. And his fantasy is, I can penetrate and I can, it doesn't say penetrate, but I create machines that give pleasure to hundreds of thousands of women out there, and that's my purpose. So I'll seed my machines and that's kind of, yeah, okay. Yeah.
I'm not that into the machines, but it was. I mean,
that guy is kind of creepy. He's sitting there with giant claws and playing with this giant claws all the time. There's a still in the Pronovation picture of that guy. Yeah. He's kind of interesting and kind of scary.
But before, when I joined the Sex Machinist Union, you know, I started shooting a lot of movies right away. You know, hundreds and hundreds of scenes with hundreds and hundreds of different women, and with the first machine. It was really felt like an extension of myself there for a while, because when you're driving it, you're figuring out, you know, early on you figure out the finesse of the machine, what it can and can't do. Say, a lot of my early machines were Symbian based, which is different from the machines that I build that are pneumatic based. So the pneumatic based, you could get a lot of more natural stroking rather than the chukka 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 variable speed of reciprocating arm perhaps. Whereas with pneumatics, you could get a more finesse of the stroke. Then on the first machine, you're able to, you know, get the vibration and the rotation going. But then, you know, they also are missing that element of thrust. And on my first big machine, it was purpose built to be internet controlled and be a video chat center. So if you guys are familiar with the original Thrill Hammer, it has these tentacle-like things that come off of it, which are actually light stands, which were there to illuminate the model while she's on the machine. And they had a big hook coming off the front with a monitor on it and a camera so she could maintain eye contact and, you know, start to forge some kind of relationship with the customer. So when they wanted thrusting, I found that I have to get my knee up underneath the thing. So I'm actually using my knee to thrust this giant machine, and I'd finish these shoots with these big bruises, but I'd have a satisfied heap on the machine. I love that machine.
Daniel, do you have a sexual relationship to the machines you're building? Not really?
I don't want to talk about that. Maybe to twist up the topic a little bit.
Okay.
I was thinking about erotic of the machine, not... So what does it need for a machine to feel, to have erotic feelings or something like that? Also, it's a little bit also the same approach as the Robexotica. So the Robexotica is the festival about cocktail robotics with different categories. And it's an ironic attempt, of course, but there are not only robots that mix cocktails or serve your cocktails or give you a cigarette or light your cigarette, but there are also robots that smoke a cigarette and just drink beer if you pay one for them. So that's maybe a question on a new topic. What does it need for a machine to have erotic feelings? And it's a lot about perception, etc. What does it need for a human to have erotic or sexual feelings? It came to my mind, there was a research about what's the minimum resolution for a display to display sexual or porn content, and it was really, really, really small. As far as I remember, it was 20 by 20 pixels and two frames. So, you know, and
we one giant big pattern recognition thing. 20 by 20 pixels.
Yeah, I think it was 20 by 20, something like that. And two frames. And two colors.
So oh, wow.
So it was very little. And you mentioned on Thursday about your first download.
Yes.
Of the...
Yes, when I was, like, I don't know, like 13 years old, something like that, I tried to download a porn picture from a German BBS from Austria. That was really expensive. And... I think, yeah, I ejaculated before I didn't even see the first line. Because it was so highly like, oh no, oh, I will see porn soon. And that, oh. Ta-da! It's highly interesting. I mean, I know people who masturbated over ASCII porn. I mean, and that's kind of cool. I mean, but back then it was not ironic, it was real.
I was just thinking about what kind of, I mean, is it the interface? I think it's not the interface which makes the machine feel erotic or sexual feelings, because Is a touch sensor enough that triggers voltage and etc.? I think that immediately leads us to artificial intelligence, which was also mentioned here. Maybe.
I have something that speaks directly to that, actually. It's interesting that you're talking about that, because I've been doing a lot of research in this area, and I've been hanging out in developers' forums trying to understand developer language, and one of the forums I've been hanging out in a lot is the Carrie Girl, the virtual date or the virtual girlfriend, that's based on the Alice Morpheus Wallace chatbot model. And what's interesting is that these girls are focused on, you know, being sexual playmates and sexual creatures, but the developers are spending a lot of their lives really, really working on what goes on with women, with their virtual partners. And one of them is summed it up perfectly in terms of what their goal is, because what they're trying to do is they're trying to create these artificial personalities to form real relationships and long-term relationships, which I think is fascinating. And the quote that I have is that I think summed it up perfectly as to what they're doing. And these are people who are, I mean, they have, like, sliders for how willing you want to make her, like a slider bar, like how acquiescent she will be that day when you are interacting with her, or how dominating she will be that day. Like, this is the type of interface that they're working on in terms of, like, working out the personalities of these artificial intelligence programs that they're having relationships with and marrying online. And the quote is, "He or she doesn't grow old. That is the kind of relationship we will ultimately have with our AI partners. And that is exactly the kind of thing that the concepts and implementations of these forum members are creating the basis for." And I think it's absolutely fascinating, because it goes beyond the sexual. They're caring about sort of how they feel and creating a space for them, for the machine to feel.
Okay. I think it would be a good idea, because we're pretty It's almost 20 minutes. It's actually 20 minutes after 8 o'clock. Yeah, I guess you have to leave pretty soon.
Yeah.
So maybe a couple of more questions from the audience for the panel. Okay, yes.
How's the medical device haptic interface doing? That's a sense of touch that surgeons are attempting to develop for remote surgery. That may be a source of additional interface technology.
I don't know. I haven't heard anything about it. Have either of you?
No, but I know that when I talk about porn studies and how arousal is measured, people always want to know what the devices are that they're using to measure arousal with. It's biofeedback.
Yeah, we're actually starting to do a little work in biosensors to map the female sexual response as far as skin temperature to respiration to the heart rate to the RR rate, which is the space between the heartbeats, and mapping out the whole sexual response. And I got interested in that because I noticed when one of my machines, my pneumatic machine, was thrusting, it stopped all of a sudden. I freaked out, looking at making sure the model's okay and looking at my compressor. And what was actually happening is she was having contractions, and it actually stopped the pneumatic actuator. So that's when it dawned on me, oh, I can measure resistance. So I could start measuring. I have a control group of 20 girls a month that I could gather data on. So we're starting to map that out, and hopefully with that data we'll be able to feed it back into itself to see if we could get, you know, have the machine actually control itself.
I guess this is mostly for Violet, although I guess anybody can respond. I'm interested for a female perspective on the fucking machine issue that you brought up earlier about this idea that it's maybe a substitute for men that don't want to watch other men fucking women. And also SF Slim brought up the idea that we need, I guess, more feminized sexual machines. It seems like there's kind of this language thing happening where sex toys are something that women or men use on themselves or their partners, where fucking machines seem to be something that men build to use on women, or at least that's the perception, since Alan said that many men are actually interested. So I don't know if you have...
I do have a little bit of weigh-in on that. I think it's interesting because it places a lot of gender assumption on what's who the viewer is. And I think that it's been interesting hanging out and talking with Thomas about membership and subscribers and just how many women are members and subscribers to fucking machines because they want to see other women fuck a machine and get off. So I think that that's something to be taken into account, where I think that we're in such a heteronormative society, I think that we're sort of geared toward assuming that the machine is the male replacement, or it is the male, the piece of the man in the porn, whereas I don't know if that's necessarily an accurate way of describing what's going on and what the interest is in what's going on, because when you take a look at what's really going on when these women are fucking the machines, the women are controlling the machines, and they really don't notice the camera at all. So there's no projection of male going on. It's the woman and the orgasm. And I think that it's for anyone interested in watching a woman take control of and power her own orgasm. And then I think the flip side of that, too, is that I think that the viewers bring a bit of power exchange expectation into it as well, where, you know, the machine is a powerful, scary thing. She's soft. She's made of flesh. And it, you know, and a lot of the sales copy that I see too that comes from fucking machines is, you know, women fucked senselessly, you know, or women fucked helplessly, and it's sort of like that surrendering, you know, that the BDSM aspect of domination and submission of giving up to the machine and seeing that orgasm happen. And I don't know that it's accurate to assign gender to that. I just don't know that that's an accurate way of looking at it, but that's. But I'm kind of have a queer perspective on it too. So,
hi, I'm kind of interested in the idea of Uncanny Valley, and I'm just sort of curious if you find that people who have like an erotic relationship to machines, do you think they're more tolerant of that or less tolerant, or how do you see that playing in? I guess especially guys who are involved with the creation of fucking machines.
Who wants to answer?
Uncanny Valley, you're referring to the idea that basically the more realistic a visual depiction that's erotic or a visual depiction of a person gets, it crosses a point where it gets fucking weird, basically, and it starts to creep you out.
Like how creepy the real doll is. Yeah. Basically, like the more realistic it is, the less erotic it becomes.
I would say that fucking machines, for instance, meaning the concept, not the site, but a machine that is designed to cause pleasure sort of avoids a lot of that. If you install it in a real doll, obviously it doesn't, but it's not supposed to look like a person. It's supposed to basically be really functional. And so I think that that's one of the appeals of it, I think. I'm not really sure.
Mine are all function built, so the machines, I also... build towards the luxury end of the market. So my customers come to me saying, hey, I want a machine that looks like this, that does this. So mine are always predicated on what the actual person buying it. And the people buying more of my machines are wealthy six-figure women that have no time to date, but they still want to get off.
I also want to add, too, that I think that there's a lot of desire to see the Uncanny Valley realized. And there's a lot of people that are working really hard to make that happen, so it's really interesting, to get through it and get the most realistic as they possibly can.
Which is even more uncanny.
Kind of hot, actually. My perception is that early adopters of technology like the DVD player or the VCR or the computer are doing it because of the erotic potential. Right there at the beginning, they want to be able to watch porn on these new formats. So I wonder if it's not a self-fulfilling avenue where, because new technology comes out and the immediate purchasers are using it for sexual gratification, that they then identify the next piece of machinery that comes out with the potential for greater sexual gratification. And so the machine becomes eroticized because we use it for erotically in a big cycle. And I wonder if anyone has any thoughts on that.
Yeah, I think the early adopters oftentimes are people who are driven by real intense need, and those intense needs are usually some sort of business reason or sex. I think money and sex are both really powerful motivators, and I think sex is a powerful motivator to spend, you know, a few thousand dollars on something you're not sure it's going to work, but if you think it might get you off. Companionship, yes, that's very true.
A machine will break your arm, but not your heart.
Okay. My, you have to get off, yeah?
I should probably go. I actually have a reading across.
The first machine that broke my heart was my stupid hard drive. 20 megabyte hard drive from 1989. It crashed. Bong. Gone. Broke my heart.
Yeah. Your question isn't for me, is it?
It was porn on it.
Okay. Then I'm going to take off. Thank you very much for including
me. Okay. Thanks. And Thomas, get yourself a copy of the book you're published in. Yes. Okay. So, yeah, please come closer. The cable is not long enough.
Yeah. Violet, you read this quote at the end of the panel, and this is a question that all of you could answer. But do you foresee, what kind of behaviors do you foresee us doing with these machines that we develop such an intimate relationship with when we pass on? Do we hand them down? Do we bury them? Do we do some other ritual?
That's a very good question. It's sort of like, you know, who... Yeah. It's sort of like the question for the lady with the pet.
Switch, because the cable is longer.
Oh, it's like the woman who leaves her entire fortune to her pet. You know, are we going to start to see that happen with our artificial intelligence relationships?
Cables.
Did you have anything to add to that?
Well, the people that buy sex machines are making an investment in the machines. They're not cheap, so I assume they'll treat it like any other asset and keep a hold of it or pass it down.
It's an interesting question, though, because it's the relationships While the developers, like in the Carrigrill forums, talk about their relationships, you know, with their artificial intelligence partners, and the hope to develop bodies to put them into, no kidding here. And even if the bodies are simply literally a ball that rolls around and follows them around the house, it's interesting, you know, the question is there then, you know, if they're thinking of what's going to happen to these things after they pass on, are they going to share this relationship with anyone in their lives or anyone else in the world? And I think that that's going to be interesting, an interesting point in history that we come to.
It seems to me so far when we're talking about eroticism in machines, there's a bifurcation, and my question for the panel is whether there's other areas that this of space to explore in this. On the one side of the bifurcation, you sort of have the fucking machines that are clearly machine, the gears that really sort of cool, intense machine basis of sexuality that's clearly not meant to be organic-y or pretend to be organic-y, it's its own thing. And then on the other side, what I usually refer to coming from the world that I live in is, you know, everybody's dreaming about building a technology that will look like a white woman, blonde with big tits. Like, that is the most, you know, that's the only thing that anybody would ever really want to do is replicate building that. And I'm wondering, is there any other space in the sort of in the area to explore with machinery and eroticism other than gears or sort of heterosexual, normative, perfect sort of body image style white, generally women, in terms of virtual creations or machine-based creations? Because I sort of live in a world where most of the people I hang out with don't think of either of those spectrums as what they would want to see created from, you know, sort of machine or software or non-biological systems. But when I look at the people that are actually working in the space, it seems like that's the assumption, is that we're trying to sort of make replicants of human beings. And in the same way that when we talk about artificial intelligence, that's not actually what we're talking about. We're talking about sort of making computers pretend like they're human, which doesn't necessarily mean they're intelligent. It just means they're pretending they're human. Maybe computers could be intelligent in a way that's not human. You know what I mean? So, I mean, can we make sexual machines that are sexual in a way that isn't just replicating human sexuality? I guess is my question for the panel.
Ooh. Okay.
I'm not sure there was a question in this. But my own opinion is that we have a kind of technological gap that, I mean, all that is built until now, as long as we don't, I'm pretty sure we can build a machine somehow one day that will emerge consciousness. But as long as we don't reach this point, everything else will be pretty much not much than just mechanical machines. And because you can always put some sentimental value in almost anything. I was talking about Tamagotchi, I mean, everybody can put some sentimental value in something, and you can put some erotic value in almost anything. It doesn't need to be close to perfection or close to the real thing. So my opinion is that you can improve feedback of the machine, you can add biosensors, whatever you want, but it's still just a machine. And yeah, as long as we have no consciousness emerging from machine, it's, yeah, I think we are all just waiting that someone arrive at this point. Then we can do something, maybe.
I think you're right. I think that there's definitely a bifurcation in extremes where it's sort of like this, you know, the soft real doll over here and like the piston fucking machine over here on the other side. And I think that there's a large desire to see something in that space between. And I think that where I'm starting to see it emerge is in the consumer sector. And it's starting to come through in a lot of different applications, such as, I don't know if you've seen any of the Wii sex videos, but just all the interesting misapplications of consumer-based technologies that are being sexualized and starting to be used in sexual ways. So, you know, there's like the Wii sex videos, and, you know, the, you know, again, to mention, you know, something like putting your virtual girl on your phone because it's an intimate device or a gadget that you carry around. It's somewhere in the middle, and I think that it's evolving, and I think also artists are exploring that space. It reminds me of what Daniel was talking about with creating a room that you walk into that is, you know, where your body movement creates the sensual experience. So it's interesting. I think it's a wide space to be developed, but I think that there's people are already going there because I think that these two extremes are becoming kind of tiresome, actually.
So I guess this is mostly for the teledildonics guy, but anybody can answer who knows anything about this. SF Slim was talking earlier about open source teledildonics, and you were just mentioning that your client base is mostly six-figure type of people, like really, really upper class. Is there any work being done on open source teledildonics or on like affordable home teledildonics?
Yeah, well, I'm in a variety of different markets because I kind of got into the sex machine business on a commercial end, so I develop products for different niches. On the luxury end, that's who buys the machines. On the teledildonic side, I want to see everybody be able to go out and interact sexually with computers. And Kyle Mishulis does some open source stuff, and I've developed some open source APIs. So everybody could talk to each other because there is no standard until there is. There's patent issues going on in that space right now. So it's, you know, it's really simple to do, and I think anybody should be able to do it. And all you need is a motor controller and be able to send signals to it. So it's really simple to do on the teledildonic side, and I think the open source it will provide innovation to the niche rather than, you know, having somebody come down on the patent of the Texas billionaires. If you're familiar with that, you can Google up teledildonics, and Violet's written on it quite a bit. It needs to be open sourced, and you know, it just has to be for any kind of innovation to happen there. And hopefully, when I patent my APIs, I'll be able to open source it so everybody could go, as I said before, go fuck yourself. Okay. And each other.
Okay. You should go to /donk. That's Carl Machuli's weblog, /donk. And Carl got...
/donk.org.
/donk.org. And Carl actually got the Prius Electronica this year, like a lifetime award, because he's one of the main guys, one of these things here, working in do-it-yourself teledildonic... Teledildonics. Okay, it's pretty late. It's almost 8:30. Thanks a lot. Wonderful panel. A big applause for our panel.